Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Like her mother country, Iran, Nahid Rocklin has a powerful, conflicted past, a past embroidered with sorrows and flashes of beauty and joy. Growing up female in Iran ultimately shaped Rocklin's destiny and those of her sisters in very different ways. Marriage, and in Rocklin's memoir, Persian Girls, marriage was one of the only options. Girls were marriageable at the age of 9. It was a primary option for Iranian women. While Rocklin's sisters were married off one by one, only Nahid was able to convince her father to let her pursue her studies in America. Her story and the stories of her sisters are very different in a country where girls dream bold dreams, but reality in the Shah's Iran was another matter. Rocklin's memoir is a story about the women in her family and their struggle for self-determination, rights, and happiness. Our guest this hour is Nahid Rocklin. She's the author of the memoir Persian Girls. I hope you'll join in the conversation this hour about women in Iran and about growing up women in general in the Middle East. You can share your thoughts or ask questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Nahid Rocklin, so glad you could be with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
I was really moved by your memoir. I read it last night. It was very hard to put down. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I felt after having written fiction for many years, because I really couldn't face or I couldn't emotionally deal with writing directly about what happened to my closest sister, Patty. Finally, I wanted to tell this story, and part of the reason was just that I wanted to put it on paper for my own sake, but also I wanted to convey how in certain societies women can get completely trapped, and no matter what their dreams, they all can get crushed, and how much determination it takes on a girl's part to be able to avoid these traps. It was somehow important to me to show that, and, you know, I know these things probably have very slow effect on cultures and societies, but I just thought maybe I can add my own voice to it.
You lived with your aunt, who you knew as your mother until you were 9. Can you explain something about your early life? It's a complicated story.
Right. Well, my early life, even though later on I realized that if I had stayed in that neighborhood, my future would not have been very bright at the time, because I was a child and my aunt was a very loving person. I was completely happy. Like, I wasn't rebellious at that stage of my life against all the oppression that women around me were facing, even though it was always in the conversation and, you know, like public baths or just in the neighborhood conversation, in courtyards. The way women talked about their lives was very, made it very obvious how little choices they had had in life. They were forced into getting married very early by arranged marriage, which was like more their parents' ideals. And it's just tradition trapped them, all the old-fashioned traditions based on partly just cultural mores and partly rooted in the religion of Islam, trapped very most women. But at the time when I was a child, because my aunt was just so focused on me and paid so much attention to me, and I was the meaning of her life, and I loved her so much, I was kind of oblivious of these things, more or less. So I had a very happy childhood.
Well, for our listeners who haven't read the book, you were living with your aunt because your mother had given you essentially over to her sister, who was childless.
Right. Well, what happened is that my aunt, though she was married, she couldn't get pregnant. And after her husband, who was more than twice her age, died, she wasn't going to get pregnant. And she had been always begging my mother, who was very fertile, she in fact gave birth to 10 children, if she could adopt one of her children and raise the child. And so the next pregnancy was me, and my mother, without consulting with my father, gave me to her. My father at the time, he was a circuit judge, and in Iran, when you're a circuit judge, you're always traveling. So he wasn't that focused on his own family that much. He was always traveling. And so my grandmother came and took me from my mother after I was, when I was 6 months old, and took me to my aunt in Tehran. My parents lived in Ahvaz, which is something like 18-hour train ride to Tehran. And so she took me to my aunt, and I rarely ever saw my parents. But then when I was 9 years old, because that's the legal age in Iran for a girl to get married, and just is legal age for everything.
Is that still the legal age for marriage
in Iran?
Well,
now it's actually, I think, 16.
Okay.
And at some point, the Shah also changed that rule and made it 16. But when I was, you know, the truth is, it wasn't that enforced. People still got married even younger than 16 then and now. The law, though, it was changed. It wasn't enforced that much. But anyway, my father at that point also had resigned from being a judge and had become a lawyer. So he had a private practice. And in fact, his office was at his own house. So he suddenly missed this child who wasn't there. And he just came without my aunt's permission, took me back. It was completely devastating for my aunt. I had become the meaning of her life. And it was, of course, devastating to me, too, because she was the mother I had known. I hadn't known my own parents as my parents. I knew they were my parents, but I saw them very rarely. And when my mother occasionally came for visits to Tehran, to her sisters, she never tried to acknowledge me as her child. Like, she wasn't unkind to me then, but she wasn't particularly interested in me or showed any interest in me whatsoever. So I was just totally, like, considered my aunt my mother. So this was a very devastating experience. But when I went to see with my parents, among my siblings, I became very, very close to this sister, Patty. She was 4 years older than me, but we grew very close because she also, for one reason or another, felt very restless or unloved, or not unloved, but neglected within her own family.
And the two of you had very bold dreams for girls growing up with this particular family, which was conservative in its own way, along gender lines, certainly. You wanted to be a writer, and your sister wanted, she loved American movies, and she wanted to be an actress.
Right. We both rebelled against those prescribed roles for us. And in Iran, though my parents were modern and not religious, that didn't mean that they were very, they were still very traditional in their views about what a girl should be doing in life.
And what did they think a girl should be doing?
They expected us to get married as soon as a suitable husband came along. They didn't expect us to go to college, and they didn't expect us to have any ambitions like writing or acting. They just thought we should, just like my mother, we should get married and stay home and immediately have children, and that was supposed to be our goal. But Patty and I didn't give in to that. We didn't want that, whereas our middle sister completely accepted that, all those roles. So it was very tragic when Patty wasn't as strong as I was to completely rebel. And I think, analyzing it now after so many years, I think the reason I managed to get out of that and Patty didn't was because I had had my aunt as a mother. Not that she was just as traditional in her approach to girls, but she gave me a lot of strength. Like, she said, basically, I should be doing what I want in life. And Patty didn't have that. Patty only had my mother as her mother. So I don't think she could rebel as much as I did, even though she wanted to. Like, she didn't have the strength to 100% reject my parents' goals, whereas I could.
So your sister ended up, well, she fell in love with someone your parents refused initially. He wasn't a suitable match in their eyes. And Pari ended up marrying a wealthy man, an older man, and that marriage didn't turn out very well.
Well, he was a very cruel person, and he was very abusive. And she repeatedly tried to leave him, but my parents kept sending her back saying, you're acting immature, you should make the best of it, he's handsome. Actually, he wasn't that much older. He was kind of, compared to other husbands at that time, he wasn't all that much older than her. But they wanted her to marry him because he was an extremely wealthy businessman. So she got trapped in a very, very abusive marriage. And finally, she managed to get a divorce. But the laws were, if you leave your husband, you have to also give up custody of your child and any claim to money. And so that's what happened to her. She never saw her son. And she kept going into these custody battles. And at one point, there was this family law, family protection law introduced by the Shah, but it wasn't enforced in court because all the people in court, you know, judges and lawyers, they still had the old ideas in their head that a woman shouldn't be leaving her husband. So nobody favored her having any visitation rights even to her child. So her life became more and more and more tragic. And so when I heard the news that she had fallen down the stairs and died, I couldn't believe that it just had happened. I knew it wasn't murder because when that happened, she was with two of her friends. But I somehow couldn't get it out of my mind that it might have been self-inflicted because she had been so depressed at the end of her life.
And you, in the meantime, had gone off. You had been gone from Iran for a long time pursuing your studies in America. You were married, and you had a child of your own.
Right. I had gone my own way and basically pursued most of my goals in that I continued with my writing interest, and I didn't marry someone they arranged for me. So I managed to get some of those goals that I had set for myself, whereas Pari didn't, because she just got pushed down by that system. And so when I heard this, it was absolutely devastating, and I had to go there and see if I could find out more about what happened. And so that's a part of Persian Girls is my search for trying to find out exactly what happened at the end of her life. And so that was it, basically.
We're talking this hour with Nahid Rocklin. She is a writer and a teacher at the New School University in New York. She's the author of the memoir Persian Girls. We'd like you to join in the conversation this hour. Hope you'll join in with your thoughts. Maybe you have stories about different divergent paths within your family or the paths women in your family that their lives have taken. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today at 12:30, Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906 by Simon Winchester. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour about growing up a girl in Iran. Our guest is Nahid Rocklin. She's currently an associate fellow at Yale University. She teaches at the New School and the Unterberg Poetry Center in New York. She's also the author of the critically acclaimed novels Jumping Over Fire, Foreigner, Married to a Stranger, and The Heart's Desire. She's also the author of the current memoir, Persian Girls, which is what we're talking about with her today. And Nahid Rocklin, I wanted to ask you about the reasons you wrote this book. You said you felt that there were so few options for women in Iran. Do you see that beginning to change?
Well, actually, it is beginning to change. It's very paradoxical in that though this regime is forcing women to cover up, and that wasn't true under the Shah. We had the option not to cover our hair and our bodies. I mean, you know, our arms and legs. Even though this new regime has put in new restrictions, because of all the internet access and that kind, you know, email and internet and all that, chat rooms, Iranian girls have become much more aware of other cultures than when I was living there. Even though we had all the Americans and English and other foreigners living in Iran, we still didn't have that much exposure to all these foreign attitudes and countries, even though Shah was trying to modernize it. Under this new regime, people are much more exposed to other cultures just through internet, because internet is more common in Iran now, more available than any Middle Eastern countries, and even some of Europe. So I do see progress there. More women are in universities than even men right now. In professions like medicine, law, engineering, they're just filled with women.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think it's just one of the, among all the bad things that this new regime has done, one of the good things is that they are valuing education for women very highly. So they are, all the parents who didn't send their kids to college, now they're sending them to these adult education courses and registering at universities. Iranian women have become extremely well-educated all of a sudden. So it's a very paradoxical situation. On one hand, they're keeping them down in many areas, but they are exposing them to more education.
And when they graduate from these universities, will they be able to find jobs in the workforce?
Well, the jobs are very hard to find for both men and women right now because the economy is so bad. But women do get jobs almost just as easily as men, except in certain fields. Like, for instance, they cannot become judges. There are certain fields they cannot, they're not allowed to, like they're not in the Senate, that kind of thing. But they can get jobs like as doctors and teachers and nurses, and that kind of thing is very open to them.
Is there a women's movement in Iran?
There is a movement kind of small ways between people, but I don't know how far they're getting as far as changing the basic laws that are still very discriminatory against them.
There is a movement, though, you say?
Well, there is a vague movement. Like, they try, but it doesn't get very far. So,
why do you think that is? Why do you think women in Iran aren't more organized?
Well, they are organized, but everything in Iran gets put down by the government all the time. The same way as you see all these demonstrations get put down, newspapers get closed down. You know, like, there is government that is always fighting it. That's why I'm saying it's paradoxical, because on one hand, they're emphasizing education, so everyone is becoming educated and aware of things. But on the other hand, any kind of rebellion of to change laws gets put down by the government.
What has become of the rest of your family in Iran? Your brothers, well, I think they moved to the United States. What about the women in your family?
The women in my family, they basically, my sisters are still in Iran. My brothers, though, who came here before me, and that was part of the reason my parents sent me here, they're still in the United States. That was part of their agreement that they would send me here so that my brothers would protect me. Like, they sent me to a very small college, all-women's college. They said, we send you to America under the condition of living near one of your brothers and going to an all-women's college. And one of my brothers was going to medical school in St. Louis, so I went to an all-women's college there near him. So they both are here still, my brothers.
What was it like when you came to this country from Iran? You had just seen your sisters married off. Their marriages didn't seem to be very happy so far. What did you feel when you arrived here?
Well, when I arrived here at first, I was, of course, exhilarated. It was exciting. I was finally here. I felt a huge sense of freedom. But the college itself was very limiting, and it was very oddly, it wasn't free at all, because we were supposed to go to compulsory church. We had to sign in and out every time we went out of the campus. We had to go to church twice a week on the campus. So it was extremely limited. It wasn't my vision of America at all when I got there. But I knew America is bigger than that college, so I wasn't about to give up on America. I knew once I get out of that college, there are other cities, other possibilities, other universities. So that's what happened, and I was finally adjusted.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about is why you were able to come to study in America. Why you and not your sisters?
Well, the main thing was that, as we were discussing before, one of my sisters wasn't interested in higher education. She just wanted to get married. That was the middle sister. But Patty wanted to pursue an acting career. She wasn't particularly interested in college either. But my parents wouldn't have sent either one of us here, except that I was doing things that was scaring my parents. Like, under the Shah, there was a great deal of censorship. And once one of my stories I wrote for a composition class was accepted by a radio station, and my father was very upset that I had written that story, because he said that this can get us in trouble with the Shah. I can lose my license. Because anything you wrote that had any sadness in it was considered to be critical of the Shah, like he hasn't succeeded in making his people happy. So it was very weird. He was afraid all my restlessness, my interest in writing, my reading forbidden books, because there was heavy censorship of books too then. It wasn't just recent, this thing on Salman Rushdie made people aware of censorship in Iran. But it was there on the Shah too. And so since I was reading all these books that I wasn't supposed to be reading.
Like right, what? What kind of books?
Well, the books were just nothing that, if I tell you, would be strange. But I was reading books like by Russian authors. One was called Mother. And Mother, I was so drawn to the idea of motherhood. And so that's why I was reading that book. And I had bought it. In, you know, like this one bookstore carried secret books like that, like censored books. And I had bought it drawn to that title. But as it turned out, it was by Maxim Gorky, a Russian communist writer. And communism was one of the real big crimes in Iran. Like, it was totally forbidden if anybody read anything Russian.
And Les Miserables was another one, wasn't it?
Right. And so my father grabbed that book out of my hand and tore it into pieces and told me to never read books like that again. So it was just more out of fear, because his license could actually be taken away if I was caught with a book like that.
I want to go back to America, so to speak, and talk about your time here. But I do want to point out that we do have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Have women in your family taken risks, maybe not of this magnitude? What has been the lineage of women in your family? And do you have questions about women in Iran and their status there today? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Nahid Rocklin, when you got to America, to the college in St. Louis, there was a very interesting story there. One of the school officials pulled you aside and said you were one of maybe four foreign students there, and they were going to have a day where the foreign students were encouraged to wear their native attire, as she called it. And you were sort of forced into a position you didn't like there. Could you tell us that story?
Right. It was very strange, because at the time, Iran wasn't even that much in the focus of the news, and people knew very little about it, actually. But they wanted us as foreigners to, like, look like the way we dress in our countries. And so the dean asked me if I could wear one of the costumes we wear in Iran. The truth is, in Iran, people dress exactly like here, only they wear the chador on the top. If they, at the time, it was optional.
And you had never worn
it. I never had worn it, even in my aunt's neighborhood, which was very conservative. And so it was very strange when she said, no, you should then wear the chador if you don't have any other kind of costumes. So that was a very bad experience because it was kind of embarrassing to me to be forced into wearing this thing that was very exotic on that campus and strange.
And you had to go to the store and actually buy fabric and make one.
Right. It's very easy to make it, but it was more the idea of it. And one of the students thought I was a nun. I mean, this was a kind of like something nuns would wear. In fact, years later, my aunt came here in the United States and visited me, and she was wearing a chador because she always wore it. And people stopped us and asked us if she was a nun. So it was humiliating at the time for me because I wasn't used to the idea of someone telling me to do that.
We have a caller on the line. I'd like to take a call from Beth in Richland Center. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Good morning. Professor Rocklin, I am delighted that you have been invited to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
I am very eager to read your work because I detect, I turned on my radio at the point where you said you began to rebel and that you had an aunt who encouraged you to live your life for yourself. And it put an electricity up my spine because even though I live in a reputedly democratic country, I was a little girl. I'm 55 years old now, but I was a little girl who grew up in a severely repressive regime that was life-threatening and terrifying every day, just about, in my own home. I grew up in a family where children were not respected the way we like to think. And
right.
It's in that moment that you spoke about finding your voice and learning to write about your life and loving to read, it was like there was no distance between your heart and mine, and you have changed my feeling about all of this, and having your courage and sharing it with all of us. I have been wanting to write memoirs for many years, and I really need to. Not only is it a need for my soul, it would be extraordinarily interesting because people can hardly believe that these things go on
right.
in a supposedly free country, but I can assure you they do.
Right. Right. But, well, I got a glimpse into that when I was in that college in Missouri where I went to college. And, you know, one thing I know is absolutely true, having lived in Iran and the United States, that there are more similarities between the cultures that meet the eye. Like, each culture has its own exaggerated form of things. And so that's why America is freer on the whole. But that doesn't mean that applies to every family, like yours, that you're saying, was very limiting. And like someone like my aunt, who had been raised in this absolutely traditional way, was so open-minded when it came to raising me. So it's very interesting.
Do you consider yourself a feminist?
Well, I consider myself a feminist, but I'm the kind of a person who's always just sitting home and writing or teaching writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not an activist in the sense that I don't participate much in outward activities. But I hope that my writing will reach, will go in the direction of helping women.
What does your family make of your book?
Well, my family, only one of my brothers has read it. And in fact, when I was writing the book, I was concerned that if any of my family members read it, they may not like it, they may get offended. But actually, no, it's not true. A few of my nieces also have read it. But my family in Iran doesn't know English, so they haven't read it. And my oldest brother just is not that interested in reading, even though it's a memoir by his sister. But my brother that I went to school near him, he read it. And to to my relief, he really liked it and didn't take any offense to anything. And my nieces have been writing me with positive remarks.
Let's go back to the phones now. Here's a call from Mary in Spring Green. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you about a poet whom I've read and loved very much, and I fear I'm not pronouncing her name correctly, but she was very popular during the 60s.
Are you thinking Farrukh Farrokhzad?
Yes, and she wrote My Heart Aches for the Garden and many other pieces, and I was just wondering, how influential was she in your life and perhaps in the life of the people around you at that time?
Well, you know what? It's very interesting you're asking this question, because if you read my book, Persian Girls, you see that poems by her are quoted all over the book, because she had a huge impact on my sister, Patty, who I have focused on in this book, because she spoke right from the heart of young girls like my sister and many others like her and myself, who felt the same kind of oppressiveness and limitations that Farrukh did, Farrukh Farrokhzad, the one you're talking about. So she had a very huge effect on young girls and everybody else.
Do you know anything by her that you could quote?
Well, not by heart, but it's in the book. I don't have the book right in front of me to quote from it.
What about you, Mary? Do you know anything?
Pardon, Mary?
The caller?
Right. Well, I was just also curious, because she had a fairly substantial impact in the world of cinema as well. So I imagine that must have influenced your sister to some extent.
Yeah, because she made a documentary that actually Farrukh made a few documentary films that also were social commentary type films. And that also was very interesting to my sister, who was a movie devoured movies and that kind of thing.
We're going to take a quick break now. We've been talking with Nahid Rocklin, who is a writer and a teacher at the New School University in New York. She's the author of the memoir Persian Girls. We do have open lines now. I hope you'll call in with your questions and comments for Nahid Rocklin about women growing up in Iran, perhaps about Iranian culture as well. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Garden Talk after 11 o'clock with Jim Packard and for Larry Mueller. On Garden Talk, Jim Packard's guest is a UW-Madison Horticulture Senior Lecturer, Bob Tomesch. We're back with Nahid Rocklin, who is the author of the memoir Persian Girls, about her journey to the United States and her leaving of her family in Iran, especially the women in her family whose lives became very different from her own. And Nahid, we have a call from Virginia in Janesville. Hi, Virginia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you for having this program. I don't think there are enough programs about women in the Middle East on public radio. And also, I wanted to talk or ask questions about organizing, feminist organizing in Iran. I believe the reason you don't hear a lot about it and it doesn't happen that much publicly is because, and I think we have to face this, women are killed for organizing in Iran. Not just killed, tortured and killed. And where I got my information is from a website called Women Against Fundamentalism, and they organize from England, because to organize in Iran would be their death. And also, I would like your guests to comment on, I have been trying since the war began to get women in America interested in helping women in the Middle East, but feminists will not touch this situation because they don't want to do anything that seems to support George Bush. And I think that's a real betrayal of women, and I would like your guests to comment on that.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I agree with you in that it's not just even women. Any man or woman who talks about changing laws of any kind that are discriminatory they're put in jail. Like most Iranian writers I know of, they're constantly in and out of jail in Iran, and newspapers are constantly banned because they said something open about these issues that you're talking about, feminism or any other issue that has to do with changing the laws there so that they are more just. I mean, laws are not just. They're just completely unjust against women there in Iran. And I think that's true about a lot of Middle Eastern countries, and I'm sure a lot of other countries don't have such great laws for women either, but there are more of them in Iran. But I absolutely agree with you in that it's a very hard thing to do because you're put down immediately.
Does that address your comment, Virginia?
Hello?
Hi, Virginia. Does that address your comment?
Maybe.
Oh, I guess we've lost her.
Maybe you lost her.
Okay. Well, we're going back to talk about Persian girls, and we do have a couple of open phone lines, by the way, now at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Nahid, in your book, you talk about a teacher you had who was instrumental in some of the ideas you had, maybe about women's rights as you were growing up, and she used to talk about how girls, she would address your class of girls and talk about how you needed to resist being dominated by men. Can you tell me about her?
Right. Like, there were certain individuals like that teacher who was very outspoken, and she wanted to direct us towards becoming more independent girls. This was exceptional because most of the other teachers didn't have such goals for us. Like, they all wanted us to be very docile, accept everything they told us, not question anything our family said. This teacher was very exceptional in that respect. And she had a big influence on me in my becoming a writer, in that she was very encouraging of my writing. And she also, like my aunt, encouraged me to become independent if that was my goal. And unfortunately, she got killed in a car accident years later, and it was a very suspicious kind of car accident because she was too outspoken for the government. And the rumor, I mean, these things are hard to prove, but because it was so commonplace, people thought that it was murder, like someone intentionally ran into her car.
And the thought was that it was the secret police.
Right. The secret police was very cruel and pervasive, and they were always watching people for anything they said that could be slightly, remotely even threatening to what was the accepted norm. And they just thought anything means criticism of the government, anything that wasn't exactly standard.
What is the status of the Iranian secret police today? Do they still exist?
Well, they have a different secret police. That was SAVAK, the Shah secret police, that actually had been put there by the CIA, trained by American CIA, because America has the same goals as Iran at the time, to keep the Shah in power. America was also as anti-communist, didn't want communistic influence in the Middle East. So America is the one who put the SAVAK there. And the SAVAK was very powerful because it had the American support. Now the new regime has what they call the moral police, which is just as cruel, but it's a different kind of a police force. They're more going around trying to make, like, women, like, what they consider immoral, like no liquor, no American movies. No, women have to wear no makeup. They should be covered up. That's what they're following people around for, this new regime. So there are two different sets of sensitivities.
And what if you get in trouble with these secret police? Is the result of the same, jail or maybe death?
Often it's jail, torture, sometimes mysterious disappearances and death. The same kind of thing happens.
What is it like now when you go back to Iran to visit?
Well, I haven't gone for the last 3 years. When I go, my goal is to just see my family members who remain there, and try not to create any problems, because if I get into trouble, they'll get into trouble, and I'll be leaving them there with troubles. So what I do when I go there, I just obey the external rules, which is covering my hair, wearing no makeup, not doing anything that I'm not supposed to be doing, like not drinking a glass of wine, you know, like things like that. I try to observe those rules and then come back, because I don't want to get them into trouble.
How do you feel leaving your family there? These are people that you still love, and you're leading such a different life in the United States, and they're in Iran, and you express concern about their well-being. What does it feel like to leave them? How do you feel about that?
I feel that I wish that's one of the parts of my life that I can never resolve, because I wish there was a way I could combine my past and present in a better way than I can, that is possible for me. Like, I'm always envious of people who can just get on the plane and go to their hometown and visit their family, and there is no problem. It's just a plane ride.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, it's just this huge psychological, and there are so many obstacles, both psychologically and realistically, that it always makes me envious of people who don't have this situation that I have, that they have such easy access to their family. I mean, even if they live in Europe, they get in the plane and go see them, whereas going to Iran is a different story.
So you haven't been able to reconcile that?
No, it's impossible to reconcile it, because it's like there is it's not within my power. It's just the way things are.
Does your family ever consider moving to a different country?
Well, it's not possible for them. It's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are many, many, many obstacles. Most of the, my family members who have remained in Iran, even though they don't like some of the inconveniences, they are still part of that culture, in that, like, majority of the ones who have remained there are observant Muslims, and they are very family-oriented. They see each other every day. They pray. All these things that are embedded in their own culture is satisfactory to them, in spite of other problems. So they couldn't move to other countries that easily. It's not, they wouldn't be very comfortable.
And what about you? We've been talking about the problems with Iran and the limited choices for women, especially the women in your family as you are growing up. Do you still love Iran?
Well, I love certain sights and sounds of it. Like, there are certain, there are a lot of great things left there that are like part of the culture, like great monuments, historical sites, just music, the old traditional music. There are a lot of things that are cultural that I really love, but which are not part of the politics. They're just like there from ancient times, and they're still there. And so those are the things I miss.
Mm-hmm. And what about it's a son you have, right?
Daughter,
I'm sorry. How are you raising her in terms of relating to her heritage, her culture in Iran?
Well, it has been very hard to take her to Iran. And because I don't have a community of family around me here, she hasn't been that exposed to my culture. But my husband and I, from the beginning, we said we let her choose her own way in life as far as the religion goes and that kind of thing. So she has gone her own way, more or less.
And considering how you were raised and the choices that you had to make or you had to fight to make, what kinds of things do you want for her? What are your hopes and dreams for her?
Well, I want her to be able to choose, have more choices in life that were given to me at the time. I mean, it was a hard battle for me to get to what I wanted, whereas for her, it's easier because there are not those huge obstacles for her. So I'm just hoping that she's going to be fulfilled in the way she likes.
And going back to your sister, Pari, you said you wrote this book in part, especially at the end, to find out what happened to your sister. She divorced the man she was married to and lost custody of her son. And eventually she had an accident, which you were suspicious of. She fell down a flight of steps and was killed. Did you ever come to terms or find peace with what you believe happened to Pari?
Basically not, because it's always on my mind still about exactly what happened. Because, I mean, my feeling is that I'm still more in the state of mind that it might have been self-inflicted, but there is no absolute proof because there was no notes left or anything like that. So I feel like I'm always still kind of a little unresolved in that aspect of my life also, as so many other things that has to do with my growing up in Iran.
Has writing this book made you feel more whole again?
It did make me feel better, yes, because I have been getting all these responses from readers, how it's reaching them, how it's they're getting very connected to it, even though they come from other cultures than mine. And that's exactly what I hope for, that other people will get something out of it too, who are not from Iran.
And your sister Pari's son, have you ever met him? Has your father, are you continuing to try to fight for the rights to see him?
Well, you know what happened is that I was trying to find him in the wrong areas. He had apparently gone to Sweden. And not long ago, just 2 months ago, I heard from him because he found my website. You know, these days on internet,
right?
You come across these things. And so he actually called me, and that was an amazing experience.
What happened?
Well, it was just, I couldn't believe it, because here I was trying so hard to find him, and here he was, he had found me. And so I'm supposed to be seeing him very soon, because he married an Iranian woman whose family lives in the United States, and they're going to come here for a visit. So that has been an incredible experience, like a positive part of my life that I have to maybe write a sequel about it.
And do you think he heard about you through this book, Persian Girls?
I don't think so, but I think he had just searching around maybe for my name, and I don't know how exactly he came across my website, actually. Might have been that he had heard of Persian Girls. That's possible, because he called soon after that. The reason I don't know for sure is because we got into talking about so many other things every time we talk that we never get around to this one thing. He's still in Sweden.
And that's an amazing story, because this was the great anguish of your sister's life after
exactly.
her divorce, that she died having never seen her son again after
right.
having left her husband and divorced him.
Right, exactly. So this is going to be an incredible experience when I see him soon.
What was it like talking with him on the phone?
I just couldn't believe it. I kept saying, I can't believe it. You know, like I kept saying that because I didn't know how to express myself.
And so you'll see him soon. Do you think that he is kindly disposed toward your family? Because your sister's great fear was that her husband would poison him against her.
Right. I think he completely has become alienated from his father, from what I gathered, because he was going to Iran right after he called me. He said he was going to Iran to visit, and I said, are you going to visit your father? And he said, no, I don't see my father. And he didn't delve into it. But I have a feeling he's kind of alienated from him, which was part of the reason I couldn't find him, because nothing was coming out about where he is from any source that I could figure out.
Did part of you think, if only Pari had held on this long, she could have seen her son again?
Most likely, yes. That's what I think.
Do you think about that?
Yeah, I think about that. It's such a tragedy. I can't get it out of my mind. So I guess there are certain parts of life that are hard to completely forget, you know, to completely reconcile with.
So what are your hopes and dreams now that you've written this book? You've already perhaps had one example of maybe a family healing with meeting up again with Pari's son. What are your other hopes for this book and your family and your daughter?
Well, I'm hoping that once they read this, I mean, my daughter actually has read it immediately, of course. It's just that for them to also understand that tragedies happen, and all we can do, maybe have some influence on the world by one means or another, if you're a writer, writing about it hopefully reaches certain people, and maybe it helps in some ways, in a very small way maybe. And, you know, and that one has to go on with life. That, you know, good things happen too, like hearing from my sister's son was amazing. So good things happen in life as well as bad things, and it's just one has to go on with life.
And that's what you've done finally by writing this book. I understand it took you a while.
Right, right. I kept writing fiction before I could bring myself to write this one. Now I'm going back to fiction again. I'll be writing another novel.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Nahid Rocklin. She's a writer and a teacher at the New School University in New York, and she's the author of the memoir, Persian Girls. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program 15E. Thank you to Carmen Jackson, who produced this hour, and to Steve Zalaznik for on-air production. Coming up next, Garden Talk with Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.